called upon to offer Isaac as an offering. So you see, there are many of these incidents in here that are very significant so far as the New Testament, the carrying out of the promise of God, is concerned. Right? So he is God Almighty, he is the everlasting God, and God Most High. Right? And now he becomes Jehovah Jireh in a few moments. And it came to pass after these things that God did prove Abraham and said unto him. Now, if your version says tempted him, that does it say that? Right, now that again, we don't use it. I mean, the word tempt to us today means to present something before an individual to cause him to sin. But the word means, it could have that meaning, but it really means to prove or to test. For instance, in James 1 and verse 2, count it all joy, my brethren, when you fall into manifold translation of temptation. A better word is trial. Fall into manifold trial. There's no joy in an individual simply being tempted to sin. But in the trials or the testings of faith that come to an individual, these work for the good of the individual. So I can count that as a joy, knowing that out of that I will become stronger, I will receive a blessing. But to be tempted to sin, there's no joy in that. But there is in trials or testing. That's what you have here. So the better word is prove. God did prove Abraham, that is, he tested him, he put him to the test, and said unto Abraham, and he said, here am I. And he said, take now thy son, thine only son. Right? Now that helps us to understand John, the first chapter, and through John, Christ, God's only begotten son. He's the only son of God, of that particular, shall I say, class or group. We're sons of God, yes, but not as Jesus was. Right? Now here's Isaac, if Isaac is God's son, Ishmael was his son, but not as Isaac. Now Isaac stands in a special relation to God, so did Jesus stand in a special relation to God. Right, so taking your only son, whom thou lovest, of course the other had been cast out and sent away, even Isaac, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains, which I will tell thee of. Now, we're going to find out later, he's in Hebron. Now, where he moved to Hebron now, I don't know. Now, how old Isaac was by now. By now, he could have been reaching 20 or older. Now, Jerusalem, which is located about 20 miles from Hebron, here to the north, Jerusalem, you remember, was located on Mount Zion, or at least a part of it. Mount Zion, and the mountain just north of Zion came to be known Mount Moriah. Now, many think, where the temple was built, many think that is the mount to which he was sent. It could have been. I don't know that. But you'll notice what he says is, in the land of Moriah, to one of the mountains that I will show thee. Now, if that be correct, then we do not know. I mean, if that be the correct translation, whatever he said originally is correct, that be the correct translation, then we are not sure that Moriah, on Mount Zion, or just north of Zion, all the difference between the Zion and Moriah was just a little declivity there. It wasn't a real valley, I mean, just a little sink there in the land, a little declivity, the best word I can think of. All right, there. Now, whether he went to that spot or not, that's where the temple was later built. That could be the spot which God directed. On the other hand, what he says here is, into the land of Moriah, to the mountain that I will show you, indicating a series of mountains there. So scholars have argued the question, and nobody knows for sure, and I don't know for sure. It could have been that Moriah. It could have been somewhere else. It seems rather reasonable for us to think that maybe it was where later on the temple was built. Very, very possible. And some think even probable. All right, but anyway, we'll not argue that because we can't settle the question. Which I will tell thee of. And Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his ass, and took two of his young men, with him, and Isaac his son, and he clave the wood for the burnt offering, and rose up and went unto the place of which God had told him. All right, so now he said he clave the wood. Well, Abraham cut it. Just like you say, yes, I built that house. Maybe you didn't drive a nail in it. Somebody else built it, but it's your house. You're the one that had it built. All right, so maybe the servants cut the wood. That we don't know, but anyway, he took the wood with him. Now, on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off, the place now that God is directing him to. Well, maybe that would be about 3 days, about the third day from Beersheba. And Abraham said unto his young men, the two men with him, abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship and come again to you. Now, as a manifestation of faith, I'm going to worship. We'll come back. I don't think Abraham knows yet just what's before him, what's in store for him. But no doubt he's beginning to realize it. Because he said he's going to prove him here. Take your son here into the land. You know, he did tell him up here in verse 2, and offer him for a burnt offering up there. The burnt offering you're going to offer. All right. So they went both of them together here. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife, and they went both of them together, carrying the fire in some kind of a censer or something where it would continue to be kept alive, live cold, and the knife, and they went the both of them together. Now, no doubt Abraham was very quiet as they're walking along. And the son begins to wonder, what's come over my father? And Isaac spake unto Abraham his father, said, my father, and said, here am I, my son, and said, behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Now here's another expression of faith. And Abraham said, God will provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they went both of them together. That's a beautiful thought. God will make the provision here for himself here, a burnt offering. And they came to the place which God told him of, and Abraham built the altar, brought the stones together there, and laid the wood in order, and bound Isaac his son, and laid him on the altar upon the wood. Now notice the submissiveness of the son. Now here you have a beautiful parallel, a striking parallel between Isaac and Jesus Christ. And in Isaac shall thy seed be blessed, or shall man be blessed in his seed. All right, now notice, he went up on the mount bearing the wood upon his back. Actually, the word cross, the word is wood. He bare the wood. He was nailed to the wood. All right, so here he bare the wood. Jesus bare the cross, the wood of the cross there. Notice also that Isaac is submissive. He does not resist. Jesus Christ was submissive, becoming obedient, even unto death, yea, the death of the cross, Philippians 2 and verse about 7 or 8. All right? And Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. And he reached over, got the knife. He's ready to carry out. Faith has been tested to the very supreme limit. I think this was couldn't have gone beyond that, could it? But now, and the angel of Jehovah called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham, and said, here am I. And said, lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. A couple of thoughts I want to note there in a moment. Now, if Abraham is to be the father of the faithful, his faith must be tested. And here it was. It was tested, as I said, to the very limit. He must be willing to give up that most precious possession in all the world. And I think that's a lesson there for us. Let's take Christ first. Christ counted not being on equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself. He laid aside the glory that he had with the Father in heaven to take the cross and go to it. I think that that becomes, as Paul said in that same passage, I'm quoting from Philippians 2, 5 through 8, have this mind in you, which is also in Christ Jesus, who existing in the form of God, counted not to being on equality with God, a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, being made in the likeness of men, being found in fashion as a man. He humbled himself, becoming obedient unto death, yea, even the death of the cross. Right? Now that's the mind I'm to have. Where am I tested? I think the real test comes when I make a decision between that which I might consider the most precious thing in the world to me, my relation to the Lord. That was Abraham's test. Offering his own son, the most precious thing in the world. Jesus Christ entered himself as the most precious thing in the world. His equality with God and became a man. He was still a deity, but he laid aside the glory. He divested himself of the glory. He never divested himself of his Godhood. He was always God, deity. He divested himself of that glory which he had with the Father, laid that aside. Whatever the most precious possession in the world is to me, to come to a showdown, that may become the test of my faith. It was the rich young man, go sell all you have, give it to the poor, come and follow me. That was a test. He didn't meet it. Abraham did. Jesus did. I stand here in the balance, making a decision at that point. In Hebrews, the 11th chapter, notice here what the writer of Hebrews says about this. Down about verse 17, by faith Abraham, being tried, offered up Isaac. Notice he was tried there, knowing, yea, he that had gladly received the promises was offering up his only begotten son, even he to whom it was said, in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God is able to raise up even from the dead, from whence he did also in a figure receive him back. So that in a figure he received him back from the dead. But the faith was such that I do what God told me to do, because God is able to raise him from the dead. Well, all right. This, I think, is the great lesson from this particular incident that we have here. And this is one of the most the very striking experience in the life of Abraham. All right? Now, notice that his faith had said God would provide. Now, verse 13. No, another point I want to note. Verse 11, and the angel of Jehovah called unto him out of heaven. Now, notice the last part of verse 12. Fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. So this angel of Jehovah, or angel of God, and the word God and Jehovah are always referred to the same, but God is the word used when power is being exerted or before. Jehovah is the God of mercy and grace and mercy. So when that is shown, it's Jehovah. When it's power exercised, it's God. Right? So the angel of Jehovah, or the angel of God, I think, is the pre-incarnate Word, the Christ that became flesh, who was with them in the wilderness. Now, Paul makes that statement. You remember, if somebody says, well, that's sort of speculation. Well, what does Paul say in 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter here, when he said, I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that our fathers were under the cloud and passed through the sea and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and did all eat of the same spiritual food and all drink of the same spiritual drink, for the drink of the spiritual rock that followed them, and the rock was Christ. All right? So the rock here which they drank was Christ back there. It was providing for them. The footnote says here, the Christ. Howbeit, with most of them, God was not well pleased, and so on. For here was Christ with them in the wilderness. Now, I'm persuaded that when you have this term, this special angel, angel of Jehovah or angel of God that comes here. For notice now, here the angel of Jehovah says, from me. And so I'm convinced personally that this is the pre-incarnate Word. That Word that became flesh and dwelt among us, who was eternal with God. Now, you may study that. Makes a good study. I know you already have. So that is there. But here's another point I want to notice here. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy Son, thine only Son, from me. Raises this question. And it's one that I've thought on a great deal, and I suspect you have. Did God know what he was going to do? He says, now I know. Does God know what I'm going to do before I'm put to the test? If I say to you that I think God doesn't know, you say, well, that limits his power. But I don't believe that. I don't believe that. God was able to create a being capable of making a decision independent of God's foreknowledge of what that decision would be. My personal understanding is, my personal belief as I continue this study, and I stop studying it. My personal belief is that when God created man, he made a creature capable of making a choice independent of his knowledge of what foreknowledge of what that choice would be. Now, God knew what he would do. He knew that if man should sin, he would provide the Christ to save him. But now, whether God knew that I would obey the gospel, now I know there's some passages that indicate that God does know what a person's going to do. I know that. There are others that indicate that he doesn't. So I'll let you make that decision. My own personal persuasion is that God doesn't know what I'm going to do till I've been put to the test. Hence the necessity of these trials and tests of faith. I don't even know myself what I'm going to do until I'm tested. I think God doesn't know what I'm going to do. But now I know that thou fearest me. Well, didn't he know it before? All I've got to go by is what he said. By what he said. And now I know, you say, well, how about Judas? But Judas's character was already formed when Christ selected him. He selected one that he knew would not be impressed by his teaching. His character was already formed. I'm talking about before the character was formed, did he know what he would do? Well, I know you've thought about that, and I have, and you may have a different view of it, but this has been my view of the matter. All right? And verse 13, and Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. Right, so here then, Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God, John 1:29, behold the Lamb of God that taketh away the sin of the world. Right? Jesus Christ is the Lamb, the offering that God made in my stead. He is a vicarious sufferer, suffering from a propitiatory offering, one that is offered for another. And Abraham called the name of that place Jehovah Jireh. Now notice here, Jehovah, that would be the God of mercy, the all-provident one who acts by mercy. And that word means Jehovah will see or provide. I prefer the expression Jehovah provided. But the other, it's difficult to tell whether Jehovah seeth or Jehovah provided. God saw the need and provided that which was needful. Right, and that's what he's done on our behalf. God saw our need and provided for it. Jehovah Jireh. As it is said to this day, in the mount of Jehovah, it shall be provided. And that's where it is provided. Now, what is the mount of Jehovah? It's our Mount Zion, isn't it? So we've come, Hebrews the 12th chapter, you've not come unto a mount that smokes and quakes, but you've come unto Mount Zion, verse about 22. You've come unto Mount Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem, unto the General Assembly and Church of the Firstborn who enrolled in heaven, unto God the Judge of all, unto Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and the blood of sprinkling that speaketh better than that of Abel. All right, now where do we find that? The mount under which we come. the amount in which God provides. God makes all of his provision in the spiritual Mount Zion under which we've come. They're all there. They're not found anywhere else. Well, that's a wonderful thought, isn't it? All right. Jehovah called unto him. So by now then he said, and Abraham called the name of the place Jehovah Jireh, as it is said, to this day, the mount of Jehovah it shall be provided. And the angel of Jehovah called unto Abraham a second time out of heaven, and said, by myself have I sworn, saith Jehovah, because thou hast done this thing, and hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, that is, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of the heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. Now I want to note this verse 16. By myself have I sworn. Turn to Hebrews, sixth chapter, and notice here where the writer of Hebrews appeals unto this when he said, by two immutable things which are impossible for God to lie. And back here to verse 13, for when God made promise to Abraham, since he could swear by none greater, he swore by himself, saying, surely blessing I will bless thee, and multiply I will multiply thee. Now that had been made as a promise, sealed with a covenant. Now then, that is further confirmed by an oath, back here in our passage here in this 22nd chapter. And thus, having patiently endured, he obtained the promise. For men swear by the greater. And in every dispute of theirs, the oath is final for confirmation. But since God could swear by none greater, whom did he swear by? Himself. All right? Wherein God, being minded to show more abundantly unto the heirs of the promise the immutability of his counsel, interposed with an oath, that by two immutable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we may have a strong encouragement who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope set before us, which we have as an anchor of the soul, both sure and steadfast, and entering into that within the veil where the Jesus as a forerunner has entered for us. All right, now here was the promise of God back here, confirmed with a covenant. All right, now here's the promise. All right, now here's the oath. Now what are the two immutable things in which it's impossible for God to lie? It's his promise and his oath. Here he made the promise, Genesis 12, and then renewed it in Genesis 15, confirmed it with a covenant of circumcision in Genesis 17, and now then, here he further confirms it with an oath. So they had the promise of God, his word, they had that promise confirmed with an oath. All right, now that was what they had back here from Abraham here. Abraham, you come on to Sinai, and you come on down to Christ. Here then is what you have back here, is the promise and the oath that confirmed the promise that God would, and that in Abraham's seed all the families of the earth should be blessed. Right? Now, are they blessed there today? Yes. God confirmed it. I think premillennialism nullifies God's promise and his oath of what he would do. Two immutable things. What does the word immutable mean? Unchangeable. That which cannot be changed. By two immutable things in which it's impossible for God to lie, his word of promise, his oath that confirms it. That sort of fixes it, doesn't it? That fixes it. All right, we're hastening along now here. Now, furthermore, he says here, the seed shall be as the stars of heaven, which is upon, and as the sand upon the seashore. All right, now back in 15:5, we had the promise there, I believe, of the sand, the stars, one or the other there. There was the 15th, there were the stars. Now later on was the sand. Now he had combined both of them here. Stars of the heavens and the sand of the sea. and the seed, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. Now that's looking to the spiritual promise now. In the spiritual promise, the spiritual seed will possess the gate of his enemies. We are able to overcome through Christ. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Now back in 12:3, he said, in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now he said, in thy seed shall it be done. Right, so we have the seed of the woman, the seed of Abraham. Now he promised the seed of Isaac. It shall be in the seed of Isaac, for in Isaac shall thy seed be blessed. All right. Because thou hast obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned unto his young men, and they rose up and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. So actually that would be the third day. It would be 27 miles. Now you see, they leave one day and another day, and then the next day they get there. So it's very probable that Mount Moriah in Jerusalem is the place where this offering was made. But it was the place of the Jebusites at that time. But it may be that he went back of Zion, he just back to Moriah there, and there offered the offering of Isaac. So at any rate, take that as you like. All right. And it came to pass after these things that it was told Abraham, saying, behold, Milcah, she also hath borne children unto thy brother Nahor. Uz is firstborn, and Buz his brother. Kemuel, the father of Aram, she said, and Hazor, and Pildash, and Gidlap, they sure run out of names by that time, didn't they? And Bethuel begat Rebekah. All right, so here then, we are now coming to things here we'll be looking at a little bit later. I'll just wait till later in order to note that. I'll come back to this passage a little bit later. And Milcah bare to Nahor, Abraham's brother here, his concubine, whose name was Reumah, she also bare Tebah, Gaham, Tahash, and Maacah. Right. Now know there are 10 children born unto Nahor here, 6 by his wife, and he had a concubine. So you see kind of a parallel there between Nahor and Abraham. I don't think there's anything that was made of it. But here he had a wife, and Abraham had a wife. He had a concubine. Abraham took Sarah there, Hagar, as such. All right. Now, I want to deal with the next chapter. I know my time is up. But since I'm going to be leaving soon, and I won't get through with this book, I'm going to go take about 10 more minutes, but there's only one or two things that I want to note here in this chapter. All right. And the life of Sarah was 127 years. Now, that would mean that at her death here, and I believe she was 90 at the time of the birth of Isaac, which would mean Isaac was now 37 years old. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, the same as Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Now, in fact, his came indicates what? He was away at the time of her death. That's all I can make out of that. He came to weep. He must have been away. The sentence told him that she had died. And he came. And Abraham rose up from before the dead and spake unto the children of Heth, saying, I'm a stranger and a sojourner with you. Give me a possession of a burying place with you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. Now, it was customary at that time, warm climate, to bury that same day, or if it's late, the next day. They don't delay very long. But I want you to note, these children of Heth would be the Hittites. Now, the Hittites dwelt way up here to the north, but they had drifted down into this country. Uriah was a Hittite, you remember. Uriah the Hittite, they were in David's army later on. All right? So here he said, I'm a stranger and a sojourner. You remember in Hebrews 11, 13 and 14, that also is mentioned there. Hebrews 11, about 13 and to 16, something like that. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, having confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. That's what Abraham confessed there. For they that say such things make it manifest that they are seeking after a country of their own. And if indeed they had been mindful of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better country, that is a heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed of them to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. So here was all of these back here, Abraham and others had died in faith, sojourners and pilgrims. All right, now that's what Peter said you and I are. 1 Peter 2:11, beloved, I beseech you as sojourners and strangers or pilgrims. All right, now a sojourner is an alien. A stranger is one who is dwelling beside these people as an alien, or a pilgrim is one passing through. So in our relation to the world, as I pointed out Sunday morning, a couple of Sundays ago or three, we are aliens to the world in which we live. We are pilgrims passing through. Or if you use the word stranger, we're dwellers beside individuals who live here, but this is not our home. Well, that's what Abraham was. Abraham dwelt beside these people. So I'm a stranger and a sojourner with you. Give me a possession of a burying place with you, that I may bury my dead out of my sight. And the children of Heth answered Abraham, saying unto him, Hear us, my Lord, thou art a prince of God among us. In the choice of our sepulcher, bury thy dead. None of us shall withhold from thee his sepulcher, but that thou mayest bury thy dead. Right, thou art a prince of God. Now they recognize that. Now Abraham has conducted himself all along in such a way as to glorify God in his life. Well, now that's what Peter said, that in the day of visitation they may glorify God because of you, don't you see? That's his conduct. That's the way the Christian's conduct ought to be. All right? And Abraham rose up and bowed himself, evidently the custom of the day there of dignity and respect for these people, to the people of the land, even to the children of Heth. And he communed with them, saying, If it be your mind that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and entreat for me to Ephron, the son of Zohar. Now, evidently, he didn't know Ephron because he was in the group there, and Abraham hadn't recognized that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he hath, which is in the end of his field, for the full price. Let him give it to me in the midst of you for possession of a burying place. Now Ephron was sitting in the midst of the children of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite, you see, we've already had them here of Heth, the Hittite, identifies the children of Heth as Hittites, answered Abraham in the audience of the children of Heth, even of all that went in at the gate of his city, saying, Nay, my Lord, hear me, the field give I thee, and the cave that is therein, I give it thee, in the presence of the children of my people, give I it thee, bury thy dead. Now, that really, he might have been willing to give it, but he didn't expect Abraham to take it. And Abraham didn't want it like that anyway. And Abraham bowed himself down before the people of the land, and he spake unto Ephron in the audience of the people of the land, saying, But if thou wilt, I pray thee, hear me. I will give thee the price of the field, take it of me, and I will bury my dead there. And Ephron answered Abraham, saying unto him, My Lord, hearken unto thee. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that betwixt me and thee? Bury it there. That's a nice way to say, I'd like to give it to you. It's worth 400 pieces of silver. And in other words, he's setting the price there. Well, men have figured that was really a high price. Now, an Oriental, they're telling me, expect you to haggle with him over a price. Whatever, pay him what he asked the first time, he doesn't expect that. Haggle with him. He expects you to haggle with him. Abraham doesn't do that. Abraham weighs him the 400 shekels of silver there and pays him. One man estimated that was about $5,000 an acre. Now, I don't know why he came to that, but something like that, and that would be high-priced land. According to our money today and then. But anyhow, he set the price at 400 shekels here of silver. And Abraham hearkened unto Ephron. He didn't argue with him. And Abraham weighed to Ephron the silver, which he had named in the audience of the children of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, current money with the merchant. That is, the money acceptable anywhere. All right. Now, what what does this indicate? Now, this land had been promised to Abraham by the Lord in promise, but God wasn't ready to give it to him yet. Right? And so he didn't receive a foot of that land in fulfillment of the promise. All that he got was a piece that he bought as a burying place for his wife. Now, later on we learn that Abraham was buried there, and Isaac and Jacob, and I believe Rebekah and Leah. I know that Rachel wasn't. I think the others were. And Abraham hearkened unto Ephron and weighed him the money there. So the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, that'd be real close here, where near to where he was staying here in Hebron, when he should move. By this time, maybe he had moved. I think he had. I think by this time he had moved back to Hebron. Now, last time the count was, he was in Beersheba. But I think between that and the death of Sarah, he had moved back to Hebron again. What? Mamre, the field and the cave which were therein, and all the trees that were in the field, that were in all the border thereof round about, were made sure unto Abraham for a possession in the presence of the children of Heth, before all that went in at the gate of the city. So now here, the thing is confirmed now in the presence of these people. The land belongs to him, and I suspect from where he dwelt in his tent, he could look over to that cave there, always close by, never very far from it. And after this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre. And Mamre was a man's name, and the field of Mamre, we learned earlier, was a field that he owned there in this area. Mamre was where he dwelt. Oaks that belonged to him, where he let Abraham dwell there. Now, the same as Hebron, so evidently, this is a part of what the general city of Hebron, or that which would include in all of it, in the land of Canaan. And the field and the cave that is therein will make sure unto Abraham for possession of a burying place by the children of Heth. That's all he ever possessed, was a place to be buried there. And later on, when they came in to possess it, God gave it to his descendants as he promised that he would. Couldn't give it to him yet because the iniquity of the Amorite was not yet full. But 400 years later, it was full. By that time, God cast him out and gave it to his people. Well, I think a very interesting part of this study, and we've had two or three lessons tonight that to me are quite important, and that's the casting out of Hagar and her son, which contains an allegory here of the casting out of the Jews and the old law and physical Jerusalem. That's gone. Our Jerusalem is above. We are children of promise. Hence, we are free and not of a handmaid or a slave. That's one. Another is the offering of Isaac as a test of Abraham's faith. His faith was truly tried to the limit, but it proved genuine and strong. And then the idea that God provides. Here in the midst when a faith is tested, God will provide whatever the need may be. He's a God that provides. So in the midst of the most severe trial, and that I think is what we're learning in 1 Peter, those trials that came upon them, and also in Revelation, in the midst of the severest of trials, God provides. This is a lesson I think we need to learn, and I think if time gets worse later on, which they may do, we're going to need that. Faith needs to be put to the test. And then the third was, with the death of Sarah, here he purchased a little spot there to bury, but nothing was given to him. That awaited God's gift to his children later on when that time should come. I have a question. Any questions? Well, let's see. We've got a good... Yes, sir. Right.
Back in 12, chapter 12.
Correct.
Then in 22, verse 18, it says, because you have obeyed my voice.
Now that's the second time. When he makes it this time, now that is assured now, because Abraham has obeyed the voice of God, but he had been all the way through. So when you read of that faith, read the statement so many times, and was reckoned unto him, his faith was reckoned for righteousness. That was all the way through his life. We don't know where his faith began. but never does it look back to the time that it began. You find him faithful all the way through. But each time that he's tested or God tries him or tells him what to do, his faith always meets the test. And now then, because he has done that and has proved himself to be the father of the faithful, then he'll receive all of this. And we then in turn, and I'd like to have read, I'm going to do it anyway, Galatians the third chapter. Now Galatians the third chapter likewise grows out of this very idea that we're talking about. When in verse 7, know therefore that they that are of faith, the same are sons of Abraham. And the scripture foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand unto Abraham, saying, in thee shall all the nations be blessed. Then they that are of faith are blessed with the faithful Abraham. Now his faith was manifested in his obedience, and God fulfilled the promise. As Brother Kirchhoff pointed out last night, here when a promise may have conditions with it. Now, when I comply with the condition, now the condition always of Abraham's faith was his obedience to what God told him to do. So is it with us. Faith is an expression, acts or expresses that in obedience. Now, that 11th chapter of Hebrews points that out. By faith, Enoch walked with God. By faith, Noah built the ark. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed to go out. And by faith, Sarah conceived. By faith, Jacob, and so on. But always that faith expresses itself in action. And when he obeyed God, now then God renews that promise with an oath now that, and you'll see that they'll be blessed. And so, it's because you've obeyed my voice. And so, if you hadn't obeyed the voice of God, God couldn't have done it. So, when God promised him in Genesis 12 that in thee shall the family of the earth be blessed, that was conditional in God's mind. So, when you read your New Testament, hear promise after promise after promise. And he doesn't say if you do this or that, but always those promises are conditioned on the individuals obeying God, not otherwise. All right, and that third chapter, you might go on, it comes on down here. Well, I'll not take time to read that tonight. That third chapter, Galatians, fits right in with all of this that we have been saying about Abraham here today as it applies to us. And I'm still convinced, in spite of the fact that a lot of people say, well, I'm going to waste my time studying the Old Testament. I'm still convinced that no individual will ever understand the New Testament as he should. He doesn't have some understanding of the Old Testament out of which it grew. I don't think he'll ever have the understanding he would have otherwise. And so to me, it always kind of irritates me when somebody says, I don't study the Old Testament. That doesn't have anything to do with me. I think a man can obey the gospel, go to heaven, and never know the Old Testament. I don't think he can ever grow to the limit of his ability in understanding unless he does understand the Old Testament, has some knowledge of it. Let me see how many we have tonight. How many got back there? Two? Two. All right. Thank you, sir. Two. I believe we got 28. Thank you for coming in the class. We'll see you next Monday. Then probably next one I'll be gone, but I'll announce that later so we won't get confused.